Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Each month, over 80,000 people download podcasts produced from the fevered mind of Royfield Brown. They cover a gamut of topics like maps, politics, American presidents, history, the Archers, Formula One, Jamaican culture, and Englishness. Go to wherever you get your podcast and type in Royfield Brown to discover a new favorite podcast today.
What does The Matrix, Rebel Without a Cause, and the classic weepy movie Titanic have in common? You might be surprised to hear what they have in common is that they are all gay. And in fact, according to Milo and Nico, all films are gay. Milo and Nico are an essentially a bloody funny couple. They analyse classic movies and discover that actually, deep in the narrative, are gay tropes. If you love films, if you love film criticism, this is the podcast for you. With their tongue firmly in their cheek, Milo and Nico convince you that every film is gay. Go download it from a podcatcher of your choice today.
This podcast is a Royfield Brown production. Find others on iTunes.
All right. Yeah, I know.
Ladies and gentlemen, please remain standing for the singing of our national anthem.
Brexit means Brexit.
My administration has accomplished more than almost any administration in the history of our country.
Hello and welcome. I'm Royfield Brown, who sat in a, normally I say like a sunny California, but it's 7 a.m. here, which means that the sun is not quite up. So it's a very dark, but hopefully soon to be light morning over here in the East Bay in California. And today we're going to speak to author Guy Mitchell, who wrote the book Global Warming, The Great Deception, The Triumph of Dollars and Politics Over Science and Why You Should Care. But we're going to talk to him. Not specifically about global warming, but one of the chief things which the majority of scientists say contributes to global warming, which is our use of energy, specifically fossil fuel energy. We're going to speak to him about the crisis in the UK's energy sector this winter. Guy Mitchell, how are you and where are you today, sir?
Good morning. I'm doing fine, Royfield. I am in the mountains of North Carolina.
Are those the Blue Ridge Mountains south of Virginia?
Yes, they are, as a matter of fact. I'm actually in a little community called Roaring Gap, which is located about 12 miles south of the Virginia border in the Blue Ridge Mountains. So we're not very far from Virginia.
Fantastic. Well, no doubt during our conversation, we'll glean a little bit more about you personally. But first, let's start with the UK's last Prime Minister and her Act of Parliament, which she brought in to help save the British consumer through dark and cold winter.
Earlier this week, I promised I would deal with the soaring energy prices faced by families and businesses across the UK. And today I am delivering on that promise. This government is moving immediately to introduce a new energy price guarantee that will give people certainty on energy bills. It will curb inflation and boost growth. This guarantee, which includes a temporary suspension of green levies, means that from the 1st of October, a typical household will pay no more than £2,500 per year for each of the next 2 years while we get the energy market back on track. This will save a typical household £1,000 a year. It comes in addition to the £400 energy bill support scheme. This guarantee supersedes the Ofgem price cap and has been agreed with energy retailers. We will deliver this, Mr. Speaker, but I will make way in a few minutes when I have made some progress. Mr. Speaker, we will deliver this by securing the wholesale price for energy while putting in place long-term measures to secure future supplies at more affordable rates. We are supporting this country through this winter and next, and tackling the root causes of high prices so we are never in the same position again.
Guy K. Mitchell, please explain to us why the UK was in this position in the first place. Liz Truss and her government seemed to make a strong play for the fact that this was because of Putin and his war in Ukraine. But UK energy prices were rising last winter before the Russian invasion. Why is the UK so susceptible to energy prices rising?
Well, I think the problem in the UK mirrors the problem, the broader problem in the EU. And that is that over the last 20 or 30 years, depending upon when one sets the comparative period, the UK has steadily decreased the amount of coal and oil that is used to generate electricity. And replaced that capacity with more natural gas production, as well as more renewables, and in particular, wind, and to a lesser extent, solar photovoltaic. So that the effect is that the dependency on natural gas to power the electric grid has increased considerably, and like the rest of the EU, now the UK finds itself dependent upon market prices. And I always find it humorous when I hear a politician like Ms. Truss or President Biden in the US talk about controlling energy prices. You know, energy, the energy commodity is a world market. And, you know, the only way that a government can try to control domestic energy prices is to do what Ms. Truss suggested, and that is to put a cap on it, which means that the government has to subsidize the difference between what is paid for world market energy and what country consumers pay. And that is a huge economic burden. And of course, that ultimately is I think what drove Ms. Truss to resign after 44 days is the realization that that was a promise that could not be kept, along with some of the other promises to try to stimulate the economy.
But doesn't the UK have fundamentally kind of a deeper structural problem in that, let's say, compared to Germany, we don't actually store our energy? So hence, when the price of energy goes up or goes down, this is the wholesale price, we're much more dependent, or we're much more sensitive, sorry, to that price increase. Whereas if you actually store your energy, at least you have some energy to be able to immediately to use before going back to those wholesale markets. It seems to me that it was somewhat short-sighted of the UK that structurally the energy which we consume, let's say liquid gas, is the energy which literally came to the country yesterday, and that wholesale price is then incredibly related to the consumer price that consumers pay.
I think that's a good point. Of course, any country's ability to store natural gas is finite. It's just a matter of the degree to which it can be done. In the case of Germany, for example, they may have more overall storage capacity, but in terms of of days of usage, I don't think it's that much greater than the UK. What may differentiate Germany is the fact that they were connected to the Nord Stream pipelines until recently. And so their storage facilities were more like a surge tank. They were more like a pass-through kind of a facility that was constantly being resupplied, as opposed to the need to perhaps receive energy by seaborne means, which obviously is limited by a number of factors. So I think that's probably the main difference.
In your op-ed, the industrialization of the European Union, you discussed how the EU traded long-term prosperity for short-term political gain. Could you explain that for us? What exactly did the EU do?
Well, I think the problem originates with the decision by the EU to purchase natural gas from Russia at what were probably below market prices. And so instead of continuing to develop the domestic energy resources, you know, I find it interesting in my research recently, I found out that the EU, and I'm sure it varies from country to country, but overall has 79 billion metric tons of coal, proven coal reserve. Now, that would be enough to power the EU energy mix at 1990 levels, which was the highest point before they began to make this trade-off, for about 285 years. So what happened was, The European Union really, I think, succumbed to political pressure from green parties and eco-terrorists to decarbonize, to reduce the amount of coal and oil that powered the energy grid, the electric sector, electric power plants, and rely on this natural gas, which was sold at artificially low prices. So it was a trade of longer-term national security and a more stable energy mix to try to satisfy to natural gas, to try to satisfy a fraudulent hypothesis. And it was, I believe, a trade-off with the proponents of the global warming hypothesis, which include, obviously, the green parties and eco-terrorists and others who have a stake in promoting that fraud.
Do you believe, let's put the EU to one side just for now. It seems to me that there's a deeper bone of contention here. Do you believe that world temperatures are rising year
no,
in, year out?
They're not. And the reason I don't believe it is, well, there's several reasons. First of all, it's important to understand that the concept of the average temperature of the Earth is a figment of the climate scientist imagination, which has been conjured up in an effort to try to prove a false hypothesis. There is no average temperature of the Earth. And I posted on my website a very scholarly paper, which was peer-reviewed and published in the Journal of Non-Equilibrium Thermodynamics, that proves this point. So there is no average temperature, and I always have to chuckle when I hear a politician like Emmanuel Macron, Angela Merkel, it could, and I'm sure there are plenty of British politicians, talk about we have to limit the increase of the average temperature of the Earth to 1.5 degrees centigrade or less. There is no average temperature. If you look at the temperature databases of the world temperature databases for the ocean, the landmass, and the atmosphere, the first 8 kilometers of the atmosphere, which is the troposphere, there has been no global warming. I mean, it's de minimis. The measurements that have been made in the case of the troposphere by satellites using microwave sounding technology demonstrate that it's virtually non-existent. The same thing's true with the oceans, with the Argo measurements, and the same thing's really true with the landmass. And the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, NOAA, that maintains these databases, they're available for the public to look at, and I have them posted on my website. But probably as importantly is if one looks at the scientific research, and I don't mean the projections of the United Nations Intergovernmental Panel for Climate Change, which has been corrupted by politics and global investment firms. But if you look at the physics of the research papers that analyze what happens when a molecule of CO2 in the lower atmosphere, the lower troposphere, absorbs a long-wave infrared photon of 15 microns in wavelength, the heat flux that is transmitted back towards the Earth is de minimis. It's about 0.2% of the sun's irradiance on a clear summer day at equatorial latitude. So the physics...
Guy.
Disproves, yeah.
Let me jump in. Okay. I do not claim to be a scientist. I do not claim to be an environmental scientist. I do not claim to be somebody who is incredibly fey with green issues. One thing I do know, though, and I think you will agree with me here, is that 97% of scientists, people with PhDs, people who have studied this, believe that the globe is warming, that the polarized caps are melting, they are shrinking, that different bits of the globe are now experiencing different or adverse weather. You can scientifically prove this because there is polarized caps are melting, sea levels are rising, etc., etc. Why is it that 97% of scientists who have studied this and have done peer review, put their names to papers, etc., are wrong, but you are right?
Well, my first response is 97% of the world's scientists do not believe man has caused global warming.
No. That's not what I said. I said that the globe is warming.
Yeah. Well, it's not. And as I said earlier, the temperature database substantiates my position. And you can go look at my website, globalwarmingdeception.com, and see the data. You buy my book and read it, you'll see the data. So it's not warming. Now, you talk about what I call, and many scientists would call, empirical evidence of global warming. I refute all of that in my book. There's a reason why the polar ice caps melt and refreeze on 60 to 80 year cycles. It's called the Atlantic Multidecadal Oscillation. And essentially what happens is the temperature of the ocean in that part of the world oscillates. It varies about 2 degrees centigrade over a 60 to 80 year cycle. And I demonstrate that in my book. And then I also quote a lot of shipping logs about back in the 1900s, when ships would move through the Arctic regions and it would be ice-free. The second thing is, if you look on my website, you'll see a graph of the Antarctic sea ice extent and see that it is virtually unchanged over the last 20 years during a period which CO2 concentration in the atmosphere increased. So the data and the science clearly proves that we're not having... And there's a book written by a fellow by the name of Steve Coonan called Unsettled that addresses every one of these issues of empirical evidence and points out that the sea levels are not rising any faster than they have been for thousands of years, that there have not been the severity of weather events like hurricanes, floods, droughts is much less today than it was
30
years ago.
Guy, all right, so... I'm looking at the UK's average temperatures from 1961 to 2020. From 1961 to 1990, 8.3 degrees Celsius. 1991 to 2020, 9.1. From 2012 to 2021, so I know they're kind of overlapping these periods here now, 9.3. And in 2021, it was actually 9.3. So let's put to one side whether man is causing this, and you've put to one side man's intervention in, let's say, the polarized caps. You said this is a natural 80 to 90 year cycle. Is this just a natural cycle that we're having in the United Kingdom right now?
Well, yes. I mean, the scientific evidence is clear. Man is not causing it, and there are not.
No, we're putting that to one side.
Yeah, so yeah.
So we are in. So let's just take these two elements. The UK's average temperatures are rising. You say that they're rising. The data says that they're rising. And then we've looked at the polarized caps. They are shrinking. Now, so these things, let's say that they're naturally caused. The world does go through, has gone through, periods of warming and freezing. We know that thousands of years ago, there was an ice age. So the world was colder. And we know that when the Vikings went to Greenland and Vineland in North America, the world was relatively warm. It's the world getting colder that killed off those Viking settlements in Greenland. Around about 1600 was, I think, the peak of this relative mini ice age in Europe, where you could skate across the Thames. So the world does naturally get warmer and colder in cycles. Now, so the question is, if we burn fossil fuels, does that add to the warming of the atmosphere? So you're going to tell me categorically no, I take it.
I will, and I'll back it up with data. I earlier addressed the physics, the science of why it does not.
Mm-hmm.
But if you go to my website, you'll see a plot of the temperature database that for the lower troposphere, the first 8 kilometers of the atmosphere, which would be the relevant to look at. And you'll see that for the period from 1979 to 1998, that the temperature anomaly, which is the comparison of a yearly average to a base period 30-year average, for the troposphere decreased every year from 1979 to 1998, during which time the concentration of CO2 in the atmosphere increased, I think, as I recall from memory, around 25%. So the point here is that immediately falsifies the hypothesis that CO2 in the atmosphere causes the global warming of the troposphere to warm, which is the essential claim of the global man-made global warming hypothesis. So the data refutes the claim. And I mean, what else can you use? And so it is absolutely. Now, I'm not familiar with the UK temperature database, but I will tell you that the database that I've looked at worldwide with respect to the landmass, and that's what you're referring to, and the stations that gather the data are called Metropolitan Surface Area Temperature, or MSATs, stations. Those are adjusted by climate science. And in particular, the Hadley Center it's the Hadley Center for Climate Research, I think, in the UK. And so scientists are taking the raw data and they are either increasing it or decreasing it for two issues. One's called time of day observation, and the other one's called homogenization, which has to do with equipment has been changed in an area. Maybe an area has grown up and now is an urban heat sink. So this data has been manipulated.
In whose interest is it to scare the population of the world into changing the way that we go and live our lives? The way that we, let's say, burn fossil fuels to impunity, or that we extract them out of the earth? Because it seems to me that just in terms of the capitalistic nature of it, the more of fossil fuels that we use, we're going to make that resource scarcer, because the fossil fuels are not really being replenished. The dinosaurs died millions of years ago. So actually, the cost of that extraction goes up. The cost of that fuel goes up because it's more rare. Surely the sensible thing for us to do, let's say that you're right and it's all a hoax and a fraud, right? The sensible thing for us to do is actually to go to greener and more renewable energies anyway.
Well, I would, that's a two-part question, and I'm trying to remember the first part because both of them are relevant. The first question is, why would there be this fraudulent hypothesis, and who would promote it? Well, first of all, it's all about the money. You know, for the UN, the motivation has been to promote it, to get funding for research, and they state this in their literature, to engage in the worldwide transfer of wealth from the developing countries or the developed countries to the developing countries. For politicians, it's all about power and control. And I cover this in a lot of detail in my book. It is about the control of the electorate. And a great example, you're in California with Governor Newsom recently mandated or issued an executive order, which was followed up by the relevant regulatory agency, that only electric cars will be sold in California after 2035. I can't imagine that it'd be illegal, but apparently it will see if it's challenged. But then the third issue is global investment firms. When Al Gore and a partner from Goldman Sachs formed Generation Investment Management in London back in 2004, the worldwide market for trading carbon credits was $10 billion. In 2019, it was estimated to be $210 billion. And at the end of 2021, it was estimated to be over $800 billion. There's a huge financial incentive for global investment firms, and they are promoting this in the greatest way. Moving on to the idea of trying to limit fossil fuels, you know, the best fuel, the most reliable fuel for generating electricity is either uranium or thorium. And the uranium, there's 1.6 million metric tons of proven reserves of uranium. And for example, France generates over 80% of its electricity from nuclear generation and exported and profited by about 3 billion euros a year from the exportation of that energy. There are about 4 billion, estimated to be 4 billion tons of uranium in seawater, which gets naturally replenished as it's extracted. And right now, the U.S., China, and Japan are in a race to perfect the technology to extract uranium from seawater. So the answer is nuclear. I mean, it's fission right now. I wish it were fusion, because that would be even even more efficient.
Guy, I'm no energy expert, but I, for one, necessarily don't have a problem with nuclear power, but it's a very emotive technology. We all know that it is. There have been, whether it's Japan, whether it's Three Mile Island, whether it is in Ukraine at the end of the Soviet Union, there have been mistakes, accidents, near misses with nuclear power, and potentially the ramifications can be somewhat catastrophic. Whereas it says to me, when you said a reusable energy source, surely that's the sun. You know, the sun's not going anywhere for the next few billion years. And one thing that we have seen throughout the world is a slow decrease in the price of, you know, solar panels. The technology is getting better. I don't know if there's the equivalent to Moore's law when it comes to solar panels and solar energy, but it would seem to me that there should be. We talk about nuclear power. If I am a small Pacific island, how the heck am I going to be able to extract those elements that you said actually do naturally replace themselves and then build a nuclear power station in, let's say, Palau or in Micronesia? Or has the government of Malawi got the financial wherewithal to build nuclear power stations? I say to you, not anytime soon. But the one thing that all those countries are blessed with, as is, let's say, Norway or the United States or Brazil, is sunshine. And I'm being told that it's not 97% of global scientists actually do believe that the Earth's core temperatures are rising. It's 99%. But so you're in the 1%, right? If 99% say that it is, And I've given you really good economic reasons why we should not be to extract a source of fuel which is finite. Surely we need to be looking at renewable sources of energy so that all of the planet can power itself and keep itself warm going into the future. And I'm not even going to say right here that the temperature rising is man-made. Right? There's an argument. I don't believe it's a strong one, but I'm not going to fight you on that, saying that it's man who is warming the planet. Planet goes through natural periods of warming and getting colder. Yes, I do believe that we are contributing to it, but I'm not going to argue with you on that. Tell me that my analysis of what we should do to safeguard the future of the planet for our children is wrong.
Okay, I think it's important to do away with one misconception. 97% of the scientists in the world do not believe that man's caused global warming.
The planet is warming. That the planet is warming, and actually, you're right. It's not 97%. It's 99.
It's not even that. If you read my book, if you'll buy my book, you'll see. That's the study that was done, that was conducted, from which this claim came. It was called Quantifying the Consensus in Man-Made Global Warming or something like that. I quote extensively from this research that these folks did. Only 32% of the scientists who were surveyed by these people, and they were principally in the United States, said they believe man caused global warming. 66% didn't respond to the survey. So set that aside. That is a fraudulent claim. But the point here is this. You know, nuclear, when's the last time you heard about an accident with a nuclear power plant in France? You haven't. And France has been generating nuclear power for the last... It's more than 85% of the plants for the last, I guess, probably 50 or 60 years. But let me tell you which countries use nuclear power. Argentina, Belarus, Belgium, Brazil, Bulgaria, Canada, China, 55 nuclear plants. And by the way, China built more coal-fired power plants in 2021, built three times the number of coal-fired power plants in 2021 as the rest of the world. The Czech Republic, Finland, France has 56 reactors, Germany, Hungary, India, Iran, Japan, Mexico, the Netherlands. So all these people are using, they're generating nuclear power safely. And to answer your question about Micronesia, you know, if the world changed to nuclear power generation fission reactors over some period of time, there's no reason why these countries can't continue to use fossil fuels. But I can assure you that the technology would improve much more so than renewables to be able to supply these countries. And if you can put a nuclear reactor on a aircraft carrier for the U.S. military, you can put one in Micronesia. But the last point that I would make is that, you know, it just needs to be a sensible decision based on the availability of fuel sources, recognizing that the carbon dioxide does not cause global warming.
All right. Seems to me that in our audience, we have people much more versed on some of the minutiae of the arguments of this debate than actually I am. And I must admit, Guy, that I read the notes from your PR really quite briefly. Let's be honest with it. I skimmed them, right? What I saw was you talking about the UK's energy crisis and the potential blackouts which might happen this winter. And I didn't read any more deeply until this morning. I didn't realize that you and I were completely on the other ends of the argument when it comes to climate denialism. I didn't realize until 2 minutes before we started the recording. So I come somewhat to this conversation unbriefed in terms of being able to counter you with specificity. But what I will say, though, is before I hand over to Ben Tristram, who's joined us on stage, is this. And you do know this, that the vast, overwhelming majority of people who've studied this do disagree with you. That's
well,
number
if you're,
one.
If you're
one,
looking,
one second. Okay. One second. Let me just do my layup. Let me just do
no,
my layup.
Go ahead. I thought you were waiting for a response.
No. And common sense tells me that from an economic point of view, and I've said this twice, but I'll say it again. If we are using sources of energy which cannot be largely replaced, the cost of them goes up. The cost of mining them also goes up. Right. So there's an economic reason why we should be moving away from sources of energy which cannot be renewed or easily renewed, regardless of what's actually happening to the atmosphere. Okay. So number one, people think the atmosphere is getting warmer. Number two, people think that man is contributing to it. Number three, cost of getting that energy is going up. It's because it's just scarcity. That's just basic economics. And then I'll say there's a fourth reason why we should show caution, is that let's be safe, let's be careful. If there is this evidence which points this way, even if you dispute it, why test the hypothesis which potentially could be the end of civilization as we know it and the ruin of mankind? I just say, let's be prudent, let's be careful, is what I would say. However, we have a couple of people on stage who are much better versed in these arguments than me. And we got Frank Rode in Germany and Ben Tristram in England. Ben, this is much more your wheelhouse. You have first dibs at Guy Mitchell. What's your question?
How are you doing, Guy? And it was nice to see at the beginning of the room, I was quite enthused to see that somebody else was an engineer. I'm an engineer. I'm interested in sustainable energy for myself. So I'm interested in this from a few different angles. I'm interested in being self-sovereign in my own ability to create power and not reliant on somebody else whose prices I can't control. So I like generating as much energy on my own site as I possibly can, because I've been a bit disturbed by the increases in prices that I can't control. And I'm enjoying producing the majority now of my own energy, which is good. And we can skip over any environmental arguments. I like the lifestyle factors of learning about my energy production, my food production, and my water production. So I like to be in control of those things. I like what it does for my appreciation of nature. I quite enjoy doing a few things the old way, in storing food underground and letting sun into my windows to warm myself rather than, you know, having to use any energy. I enjoy that side. And I particularly enjoy saving money and not spending more money on energy than I need to. So that's kind of where I'm coming at it from. And my conclusions are quite simple. Where I live, I produce as much of my own power as I can. And as much as it's tempting to use fossil fuels because they're 10 kilowatt hours per kilogram, they have a high specific energy, it's not necessary anymore when there's, you know, I've got 2 acres of land and lots of sun landing on it and lots of batteries that I recycle from other people's laptops and so forth. And I don't really need to do anything new. I just fiddle with what's already here and create my own energy. So that's where I'm coming from with it. Whether I have a question, I don't know, really. I think I do have a question, but it's not a scientific question. I have an ad hominem question, if Roy would let me ask it. I mean, I just want to understand what's your affiliation? It doesn't quite compute to my brain. So you're an engineer. By the way, I like nuclear. I think that modern third and fourth generation nuclear, I can't see any issues with it, and I would like to see it used a lot more. And fast breeder reactors using uranium from the oceans could give us twice the average American's energy consumption for 1,000 years. So, I mean, I personally have no issues with that. So if you're mainly pro-nuclear, cool. But it costs, as far as I understand, if you compare the cost over the lifetime of the energy produced by a nuclear plant to setting up a renewable plant with storage, I think, in depending on where you are in the world and which technology, I think they're comparable now. This is the bit that I don't understand, is why you'd build a large-scale new nuclear. So this is my question. Why would you build a large-scale new nuclear plant with current technologies? And sure, your argument, I think, is that the nuclear will get better if we do more of it. But why would you build that now when in some geographies, depending on the geography, some places you're going to need to pick solar and storage, some places you're going to need to pick hydro, some places you're going to pick hydrothermal, some places you're going to pick whatever. Why would you do that if the cost over the whole lifetime per whatever unit energy produced is at the moment roughly break even with renewables, as far as I can see, depending on where you are and what the options are on the table. Why would you go down the nuclear route?
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Okay, all great questions, Ben. Let me try to take some of the points you've raised in order if I can. As regards my motivation, I have no idea. I told Royfield prior to the broadcast that really my interest in science really has to do with theoretical physics and particularly particle physics and the experimentation that's being done by CERN with a Large Hadron Collider. I'm interested in trying to understand what the force carrier is for gravity. So I just got sucked into the vortex of this global warming issue as a result of attending a dinner party about 5 years ago when a friend challenged me, as Royfield has, about, you know, 97% of the world scientists believe man's caused global warming. Well, that statistic is not true. But anyway, that's how I got drawn into it. I have no affiliation with either proponents or opponents of the global warming hypothesis. Number two, let me be clear about this. I think wind and solar voltaic cells are cool. I like them from a technical standpoint. The problem is right now, the technology is not sufficient to power the base load grid of an electric grid. And so I think from what I understand, well, for two reasons. Number one, sometimes clouds obscure the sun and sometimes the wind doesn't blow. Now, I've done some research on the storage technology. You're probably much more knowledgeable than I about how long you can store power that you have generated and charged into batteries with solar voltaic cells. But I think it's measured in maybe a handful of days or so. Overall, I mean, having studied it, there are a couple of issues. Number one, I think that wind and solar works great for consumer generation like you're doing, because you don't get into issues. The problem is when you talk about baseload generation, you get into issues of voltage drop across a large distribution network. You know, if you've got solar voltaic cells on your house, that's not an issue. And I think all this technology will be worked out. But right now, the power that's generated from renewables is generated at what's called an asynchronous frequency, which means in the U.S., our power grid operates on 60 hertz, 60 cycles a second. I think in the U.K. it's 50. But what happens is if the frequency of the electrons that are flowing from these sources drops below a certain level, it causes a lot of issues on the grid, and it's a challenge. I watched a great video, which I'd recommend. I'm trying to remember the name of it, but it was a technical presentation about this. So,
Guy, can I jump in just for a sec there, just with a super live fact. At this moment, according to the Grid Carbon app from Oxford University, and I check this regularly independently, you can go and get that on the iPhone or on the Android, Grid Carbon, or one word. As I speak to you, the UK is pulling 34 gigawatts of power. 37% of that is coming from wind. 6% of that's coming from solar. You have 35 from gas, 13 from nuclear. So we're getting 37% of our electricity from wind right now. The problem must be solved because we are often getting most of our power in this country from on and offshore wind. We sometimes are getting all of our power between wind and solar on occasions when it's windy and sunny in the middle of the summer. So we are already supplying an entire country on wind and solar at times. So whatever the argument here is that is not possible cannot be true because we are doing it right now. Yes, you can store for a few days in somewhere like Norwich, a pumped hydro storage system that can be done. Any ideas about not being a modern inverter, not being at a frequency match to the grid, just makes no sense whatsoever to me. You can buy an N-phase inverter for $50 that can do that. You can do that at any scale. You can do that at domestic scale or you can do that at country scale. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter how many of these things you have. So this doesn't. And the point is the UK is, as I speak to you, 37% of our power is coming from wind and 6% from solar. And it's quite late in the afternoon. Earlier in the day, it was 80% of our power was coming from renewables.
The only thing I can say is that obviously the technology, particularly with respect to the wind, I think as long as you have sufficient force, you can vary the blade attitude and you can maintain the frequency of generation. But there are several research papers that address this issue, Royfield, that can explain this better than I can.
I just want you to explain how my country is currently taking over a third of its power from wind as I speak to you, the whole country. I haven't had a blackout, a grayout or anything for about a year. We have hardly any blackouts, grayouts or problems. There are times when the country runs entirely, 80-something percent off renewables. How is that happening when you're telling me that that's not possible? It is happening here now. Sure, overnight we burn a lot of gas. So I don't understand how it's happening when you're saying it can't happen. I'm confused.
Well, the only thing I can tell you is that I've read several research papers that talk about the challenge of...
Okay. We're doing it. It works.
I can't answer you. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm sure you can't because the answer is it works.
And I hope the UK increases the percentage of wind power because I got news for you. The price of natural gas is going to increase considerably.
Ooh, and so, yeah, I hope it does.
You know, maybe what Ms. Truss should have said was we're not going to cap the price of energy. We're going to go build more wind turbines. Maybe she'd still be in office.
Yeah, that would have made more sense indeed. But the price of fossil fuels going up is fine. I mean, look, we're not on substantially different pages. I'm gonna have to run in a minute because I've got to go prepare a room on sustainable energy. But I think people are irrationally scared of nuclear. I would love to see more recent nuclear produced as long as it can actually compete on a cost basis with sensible choices of renewable mixes and their appropriate storage. But I just think that it's becoming a moot point because we're kind of at the point where the renewables are just the cheapest option anyway. I'd love to see all current nuclear plants carry on running as safely as possible until they're done. But new large-scale nuclear doesn't make a lot of sense. Smaller scale, I'd love to see that. As you say, the things you stick on nuclear submarines and the like, I'd love one of those, a little mini modular reactor for my house. I'd buy one of those tomorrow because that'd get me through the winter just beautifully. Because renewables is really hard to get through the winter in the UK on a personal level with renewables. Easy enough at a country level because we've got, we pump billions of tons of water up mountains and use that to go through the lulls and sloughs in the power. But yeah, so I mean, we're not substantially on a different page until you get to the bit about the bunkum about us, about carbon dioxide and the climate. But that's a different issue. We can talk just about renewable power and power and the sources, and it still adds up, as Royfield's saying, from a cost point of view. So,
well, again, anyway. I'm not opposed to it, but I will say this: until the technology changes, you're going to have a backup for renewable power generation. And that's got to be, and quite frankly, it's got to power the base load of the grid, meaning it's going to have to be more than 50%, because I'm assuming that if Ben's renewable energy sources don't work, I guess he's got a means of getting line power. I don't know. But you mentioned 37%. I think there are countries probably that generate more than that. So, I think that there are technical issues, but at the end of the day, you're going to have an alternative when the wind doesn't blow and clouds obscure the sun.
Well, so I'm going to have to run, Guy, but the answer with me is simple, and it's the same for the country. You massively over-provision on things like solar. Even on a cloudy day, you can get plenty out of solar. With the right storage, the right over-provisioning of solar, and sufficient over-provisioning of wind, the probability of a period where there's no wind and insufficient solar, it can be diminished down to so small that it's vanishing. So you can do that on an individual level, and you can do that on a country level, I believe. But we do need to be careful and sensible about this, because it only just adds up. If we continue to increase our energy use as we are, we are going to end up in a problem. So the real problem is consumption, which nobody talks about. If we could halve our consumption, buy half as much stuff, take less long-haul flights and so forth, then actually the new renewables would add up much quicker. The risk is that we keep chasing our tail, keep increasing our consumption, and make our job of doing everything renewably very difficult. But anyway, just some thoughts.
Very good.
Ben Tristram, thank you for coming on and at least applying some scientific opposition to Guy's positions. I think what I did was much more of a philosophical opposition, trying to understand in the wider sense of what Guy was saying. We are up to the 1 hour point of recording this podcast. So I'm going to start to wind things down. But Frank, you've been on stage for quite some time. So Frank, now is your time to throw a question to Guy, if you have one.
Well, good evening from Germany. I'm a social scientist. I worked at a chair for sustainable development in climate science communication. And I actually worked with some world-renowned climate scientists, just like, for example, Stefan Rahmstorf, who's the director at the Potsdam Institute for Klimafolgenforschung. He, for example, looks into the temperature anomaly in the Atlantic Ocean. And he published an article about climate science denial some years ago. I think it's almost 10 years ago. There are a couple of things that everybody could look up and compare to your work, Guy. But, you know, as a scientist, you know, whenever you have a hypothesis going, you have to apply some Karl Popper, something that could actually prove you wrong. So my question, Guy, would be, what type of argument, just generally, would convince you that what for a meta-analysis from 2021 or one from 2019 found, so it's not the consensus, it's not 97% anymore, it's more than 99%. So what, more than 99% of the scientists, the relevant scientists in the field, are actually agreeing upon that the climate change is human-made. What would convince you of that?
Well, Frank, let me say first that you have a countryman by the name of Dr. Herman Hardy. I published some of Dr. Hardy's.
My question was particularly, what would convince you that climate change is human-made?
I mentioned the research by Dr. Hardy at Helmut-Schmidt University. If the research was, if there was a consensus, if there were no disputes about it, that would convince me. Number two, if the temperature database of the world's, if the world's temperature databases for the troposphere, landmass, and oceans depicted a sustained period of global warming that was consistent with increased carbon dioxide in the concentration atmosphere, that would convince me. If someone could explain to me why there is an average temperature of the Earth, then that might convince me that would be a metric to use, because the problem is there is no average temperature of the Earth. The Earth is not in thermal equilibrium. The temperature of the Earth is different at every point in time and space. And I posted on my website a great research paper that refutes that concept. It was published in 2007. So If I could see the data, if I could see objective data, the UN IPCC scientists do not publish research that corroborates the global warming hypothesis. They develop computer models that predict what the temperature of the average temperature of the Earth, which has no meaning in science, might be based on the increase in the concentration of CO2 in the atmosphere. So if I could see, if somebody could show me the data, if somebody could show me the physics that corroborated this fraudulent global warming hypothesis, I'd sign on. I'd be one of those 99% that you think believe this. But I need to see the data. I need to see the science. And so far, neither of them confirms the hypothesis.
Guy Mitchell, thank you for coming on to Mid-Atlantic today. Thank you to Frank. Thank you to Ben for being the collective kind of hive mind that the 99% who are a little bit more informed about the actual science of global warming than me. I must admit, I kind of believe in experts, Guy. And if 99% of people are telling me something and governments throughout the world are kind of moving in that direction of this level of expertise, I kind of think that there must be the data to back this up. I think that I countered you with at least four reasons as the reason why us burning and using sources of energy actually isn't good just from an economic point of view. But I don't have Ben's specificity of knowledge when it comes to looking at, let's say, wind. And I think Ben made an excellent point when he said, right here and now, 2/3 of the UK's energy grid is being powered by wind, something which you said wasn't possible, but it is possible and is actually happening right now. And just the last point, which I made timidly, I'm going to make a little bit more forcefully. We should have an insurance policy in terms of how we power the planet in the future. That, let's say, that there is just general dispute as to whether global warming is a man-made phenomenon. I don't really believe that it is fundamentally a dispute. I think there's overwhelming evidence that says that the globe is getting warmer and we are contributing to it, us as human beings. But let's just say that this is like a 50-50 argument. Why wouldn't you at least hedge your bets so that our children have a planet to inherit, is what I would say. You know, and that's before we look at some of the other arguments. But Guy K. Mitchell, you've taught me a lesson today, sir. And that lesson is, when I get notes from PRs and when I'm having people on the show, I should read them much more deeply. And one thing I would say slightly in my defense is because it's now 8 o'clock here in California, and I got up early to do this, I thought to myself, what would happen is I'd have a good hour and a half before a guest comes onto the show and I'll read up about them. With you, it was literally 3 minutes because I only rolled out of bed some 20 minutes before. And that's me being human and very honest about it. I do appreciate you coming on. And again, I'd just like to thank the hive mind, Ben Tristram and Frank, for coming up onto the stage and at least challenging you, sir. But we say this to every guest that comes on to Mid-Atlantic. If people are interested in your thoughts and your theories, Guy K. Mitchell, where can they find them?
My book is available on Amazon.com. The title is Global Warming, The Great Deception, The Triumph of Dollars and Politics Over Science and Why You Should Care. And it's also, you also can see a lot of the data that I've represented to you today on my website, including the ability to purchase the book at www.globalwarmingdeception.com. And gotcha. I appreciate the opportunity to be on your program. And I always enjoy having people challenge me about the comments that I make.
Again, I don't really know the science, but as I said, Ben made a really valid point. And I think the next time, before you refute the validity or the scalability of wind power, you need to look at some live examples. Anecdotally, when I travel from Birmingham to London on the M1 and M6 motorways, there's nothing but wind farms down that motorway. When I get to Brighton in the UK, purely anecdotally, and you look at the sea to France, it's full of wind farms. They have an eerie beauty to them, but even I was somewhat blown away by what Ben said, that some two-thirds and sometimes as much as 80% of the UK power grid is actually powered by wind. Anyway, good people, you've listened to an episode of Mid-Atlantic where maybe I've shined a little bit too much of a light onto my own personal habits, i.e. I didn't properly prep for this episode. And so the conversation took a turn which I wasn't really expecting. I thought fundamentally we were going to be talking about the UK's energy sector crisis and the fact that this winter there could well be blackouts in the UK, something which happens, dare I say, quite frequently in the Bay Area, but something which doesn't happen actually in the UK. Very obviously, the UK government has made some level of a provision to safeguard against Britain's going cold this winter, but energy prices have skyrocketed, and that skyrocketing of these of energy prices isn't just to do with Putin's war, because actually energy prices were going up beforehand. I did say at the start of the show that the fundamental reason for the UK being susceptible to the wholesale price of energy is because we don't actually store any of it within the UK, and as opposed to, let's say, Germany or the European countries. Though we do have a very diverse pool of energy sources which we take our power actually from. So it's something which we need to look at for the medium to long term in the UK. How are we going to structure our energy system so that in future we're not at the vagaries of price fluctuations on the global. But only time will see if we have a government that can take control of our energy sector to put those strictures actually in place. That's been me, Royfield Brown. Don't forget, left of centre politics is right thinking politics, but we don't demonise our right leaning brothers and sisters. We just try and win them over the strength of our argument. That's been a Mid-Atlantic, and if you learn anything from this, it's you go into an exam, do some prep, because I didn't really today. But Guy K. Mitchell, thank you for coming on to the show. Thank you again to our two people from the audience who also came up. Take care, look after yourselves. You'll have another Mid-Atlantic soon. Bye-bye.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.